Good evening. I just realized as I was walking out here that I forgot to... Purple's okay, right?
Yeah.
There's something black for later. So welcome. Tonight's concert, when I programmed it, I thought, okay, this is the one that's going to be a hodgepodge. This is going to be the stylistic contrast concert. One piece has nothing to do with the next piece. There is no theme. And as usual, what happened is, in the process of our rehearsal period, a theme is revealed somehow to me. And in this instance, we really do have really contrasting styles, time periods of the composers. Copland, François de Vienne, who I frankly not heard any music of before this piece, and Sibelius. I mean, how different could you be? But really, they are very, very different composers from one another, but their individual expression is a commonality between them, between all three of them. The vocalism in their music, the lyricism in their music, but there's a definite connection between Copland and Sibelius, and that is that they're essentially both national musical heroes of their countries. When you think of American classical music, you think Aaron Copland, especially symphonic music, and his music somehow, and I know it was by design on his part, but intuitively and naturally, he sounds like us. He sounds like our country and our way of life, somehow in his use of intervals stacked upon one another and his melodic writing. And when you think of Appalachian Spring and Hoedown and Fanfare for the Common Man, that's American music. It's Aaron Copland. Right, but it's American somehow in its quality, not just because he is American. And then Sibelius was celebrated almost as a national leader on a presidential scale for a composer. I mean, his music was lit a fire under the Finnish people as they were right in the middle of asserting their national identity, emerging from the governance of Sweden and the oppression of the Russian Empire, and finding their own voice and asserting their own storytelling and culture and language and music. And he really was a leading national figure, aside from being a composer, but it was because of his music that he was that leading figure. So there are these through lines that pop out at me as we're working on the repertoire together. And de Vienne, you'll hear in this beautiful flute concerto that we're so incredibly lucky to have Annie Wu here to play. The beautiful vocalism in the writing is just exquisite. The interpretive range is just as broad as the technical pyrotechnics and virtuosity that you'll hear in the flute. So I hope it's an interesting program for you. So we begin with Our Town. And somehow this is really stuck in my mind, as we've been working on this piece. I haven't been able to let go of Thornton Wilder, and I ended up sharing some of this with the orchestra last night because I've been trying to figure out how to make the piece have the quality that I want it to have. And so I reread the play a couple of days ago and forgot it's really short. It's a very short play and very sparse. I hadn't read it since I was probably 18 or 19 years old. And to go back and read it now from the perspective of my 40s, with children growing fast and parents aging fast and me having lived a long time now and, you know, hopefully have a ways to go, it's profoundly different. And I told everybody the other night I had to have a Kleenex box right away, you know. I'm sure many of you know the play and remember it, but just to bring you back a little bit to it, Thornton Wilder's stage directions require that there be no set, no props, and it's pared down to just the people. Maybe a few chairs, maybe a table, some ladders to show houses. And that has the effect of focusing us absolutely on the humanity of each individual character, even in the manner in which they mime their props, their use of the things in their lives that in the play seem so important to them. We learn throughout the progression of the story that we fail as humans to look away from those small details that grab all of our attention and time and look towards each other and really notice one another. And so we in the audience notice them doing that because they're mining all their repetitive daily routines. And what the reason I mention this is because that's what struck me about Copland's music, is that's what he captures so simply and so elegantly in his music for this piece. The daily repetition of routine is captured in very simple melodies that repeat many times over in this short piece. Simple little tunes that are just based on a triad. Da 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 da. You know, something really familiar you could probably sing along after the second bar. But what he does is he underscores that with a very open-spaced harmonic language of open fifths and fourths stacked on each other, which is very Copland-esque. That is a characteristic choice of his harmonically. But those open, warm chords that you hear in the low strings and brasses change by a whole step down, and the same melody is playing. And then rise again a whole step up, and then rise another whole step up, and then settle down again. And as the shifting harmony moves, we hear that familiar tune so differently. It carries a new weight. It sounds affected. And that, to me, is like a device for looking back on your life, to hear the same melody that you've become so familiar with and hear it so changed just when they drop down a whole step. It's kind of, it is a great way of describing the process that the characters go through in the play of their everyday lives. And I think it captures his voice, Thornton Wilder's voice. And I just want to read to you from what the stage manager says in Act Three. This is when we've met everyone in the graveyard and they're looking back on us, the living, and everything that we're doing wrong and missing. And our main character, Emily, shows up surprisingly soon in her life. And here is where we hear this part of the speech. We all know that something is eternal, and it ain't houses, and it ain't names, and it ain't earth, and it ain't even the stars. Everybody knows in their bones that something is eternal, and that something has to do with human beings. All the greatest people ever lived have been telling us that for 5,000 years, and yet you'd be surprised how people are always losing hold of it. There is something way down deep that's eternal about every human being. And so having said all of that, I'd like to play you just a little bit of Our Town, but you'll hear the piano transcription played by James Tocco. This is Copland's piano transcription.
What's it called?
There's a land that I see. Oh, Free to Be You and Me. And Sibelius Symphony No. 2. But I don't even think I knew that it had a name or that Sibelius wrote it. It was a record my dad had. And I would sit behind the wing chair and spend hours listening to this symphony. And it took me wherever I wanted to go. It made me feel like I could fly. It produced large cinematic plot lines that went forever in my mind. I mean, Star Wars had nothing on my personal take on Sibelius Symphony No. 2. And on the album, it was followed by the Moldau. And I had no idea that that wasn't the fifth movement of Sibelius 2. Doesn't sound anything, no connection really, but anyway, Sibelius, he follows all the traditions. He's a classical symphonist in the late Romantic era, pushing forward into the 20th century, into modernism. But he's traditional in the way he writes his music. So all the conventions we expect, sonata form, a three-part, you know, something that we hear at the beginning that returns at the end and develops. These are all present, but his approach is so unique and so personal and so different than everyone else's. And all of his symphonies are incredibly different from one another. The second is a totally different piece than the first. The seventh couldn't be more different from the sixth. They do share qualities, like long, sustained, sweeping, soaring sounds, as if a painter is painting with the orchestra. And those long, sweeping sounds are interrupted by sudden, very, very sharp, energetic pulses that shock you. And in this symphony, it's really a battle between the forces of something light and freeing and something very dark and oppressive. And of course, in 1899 in Finland, that was representative of the current scene. So in this symphony, I'll be here for 3 hours talking about Sibelius. It starts in a wholly unique way with one lonely clarinet with just the murmur of timpani underneath to add a little tension and support. And a lot of people feel like this is just one of those slow introductions that sets the mood and then we start the symphony. That is not at all the case here. The clarinet solo you hear is a very, very long solo, and in it is every single piece of melodic material that will be used throughout the rest of the symphony, not just the first movement, the whole thing. Everything from the very first few measures are literally repeated at the beginning of the fourth movement, but the second half of that solo creates a second theme in the second movement. The little intervallic relationships are all messed around with and changed and become something that sounds new but isn't. It's completely derived from that solo. And I was saying to the orchestra that to me it feels like he had to have composed the symphony backwards. Because how could he know? He must have known where he was going in order to know where to begin. So I'm not going to play that solo for you. That's Leslie tonight. But what I will play for you is the primary theme of the Allegro in the first movement that emerges sort of seamlessly out of that solo. And what it is the violins and cellos exchanging a long-held, sustained G in the key of G, which is a bright, sunny major key, and that long note pushes and strives for something and is reaching and then punctuates down into E minor. And that sets up the whole narrative for the entire symphony, this battle between major and minor, light and dark, and it's just gorgeous. There's the first theme. Totally different character. Here, the trombones sort of lead us into this shimmering texture in the strings. Very, very fast, soft bows. And the harp enters in a kind of duet with the woodwinds and horns. It's very pastoral, it's very idyllic, it's very evocative of nature, which is something that Sibelius is widely known for. Secondly, rhythm, which is ta, 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 ta. And that rhythm becomes very important throughout the rest of the movement. Here's the second movement. Into the stratosphere with the flute and down into the basement with one solo bass all at once, which is something that Sibelius loves to do to create vast space in music. Here's the second theme. So the third movement, the scherzo, The scherzo has a wonderful theme. It's playful and it messes with your mind. You know, what meter are we in? How many times are we going to hear it? Where does it enter? Who has it next? And it is a theme that it's repetitive and forceful in character, and it's first played notably by the timpani, which has a huge role in the symphony and especially in this movement. It's the timpani's movement. And you hear that forceful energy in the timpani right away, but then later it's a playful little dance-like scherzo. So he can change the character of this theme on a dime, and it makes for a wonderful scherzo. This is the theme from that movement. That movement is really fun and energizing and inventive. There's a trio in this movement, which comes right out of the end of the scherzo. It's a very big surprise, and you'll hear in this example that I'm going to play, you'll hear the scherzo finishing and leading into the trio. The trio begins with this very long, sustained note in the horn that is sort of similar to that long, sustained, striving note in the first movement of the piece. And it's played over a very dissonant, uncomfortable chord that then resolves in sort of relief. And this is the one where we rise up with the flute and descend with the bass and have this wonderful, wonderful space in between. Here's the trio. So many different moods he makes just with the use of the orchestra, never mind how beautiful the melodic writing is. And then the last movement, we arrive at the beginning again, only in a very different character. The clarinet solo, the theme you hear at the very beginning, returns in an introductory theme to the fourth movement, and it's played out with full appassionato, full load from the string section. This is it. Here. from slow, long-lined themes into this very angular, fugue-like music, and there is sort of a fugato in the middle of the allegro section, like that sort of acts as a development section. And then finally, and I'm gonna leave this excerpt out. Don't play this one. You should just wait for it, like we do, like we have to. The second theme of this symphony is, I don't know which Tchaikovsky melody you love most, but Sibelius beats them all with this one. It is one of the most, well, maybe not them all. It's just a gorgeous second theme that is strongly akin to that beautiful theme from the second movement. And it's an open question which one of these themes wins in the end. We're constantly moving and shifting in this last movement like a battle between dark and light, between this highly energized, aggressive allegro music and this very, very long second theme, which I'm gonna leave for the orchestra to do for you tonight. And I hope you very much enjoy it. And of course, our highlight this evening is that we get to welcome home Annie Wu to play this wonderful, wonderful piece that she's bringing to us tonight, François de Vienne. He lived right smack during Mozart's life, and you can hear that in his music, but he's no slouch of a composer himself. He is inventive and ingenious in the way that he builds and develops his melodic ideas, and he surprises us by continually adding one more new theme and alternating between major and minor where you would least expect it. It shows an extraordinary range of what the flute can do, and not very many flutists can play it the way Annie does. It's absolutely marvelous. And you'll hear in the slow movement, for me, that movement is you know, the big act two aria for a soprano in a Mozart opera where everybody leaves the stage and she's alone with her thoughts and finally turns to the audience and tells us what's really going on. And that soulful, creative impulse of a voice that comes out in a moment like that is exactly what Annie brings to this music and to everything that she does. Not only does she play beautifully, she's a wonderful visual artist and a painter as well. And what a treat. This is her second visit to us in less than a month. She was here in March on her spring break from her first year in college and came with us into the schools, a small group of musicians, myself and Annie. We visited some schools in Livermore and Pleasanton and treated the kids to some music right in the middle of their school day. And we're so grateful for her to her for taking that time. And those kids would not let her leave. She was a rock star. They would not have believed it. They did not want her to go. So, and several of them came back at the dress rehearsal to hear. Anyway, it's so wonderful to have you all here. Thank you for coming. I'll go change my clothes now. And I hope you really enjoy the performance.